it on my linear. And so there are people out there who are pushing FT8 at 1.5 kilowatts and hell of a duty cycle. So I don't know how long their linear is going to work is doing that, but apparently it's working out for them. But yeah, it's curious how I've heard about those contests. I don't remember the specifics, but it's not like they give them really handicapped systems. They give them really nice systems, but they're identical. And so, yeah, that kind of gets rid of all the extra variables, and you're left with just your technique as an operator making the difference between you and the next guy.
Yeah, it is an interesting idea in contesting. Of course, you know, some people probably feel less ridiculous because they feel part of the challenge of contesting is to be able to set up the best possible station, not just operate it.
Yeah, but I tend to think some people are kind of over-competing. There are guys that put a lot of money on a contest site. You know, I mean, there are more than a few of these contest call signs that everyone has learned about, and they show pictures of them, and they're racks upon racks upon racks of transceivers and antenna farms in the back. And, you know, I guess it's their money. They can spend it any way that they like, but it seems a wee bit excessive personally. But, you know, I guess bragging rights, and if you got the money, you might as well use it on something that you enjoy using it on.
Yeah, it is amazing the amount of money people spend on contest stations. You know, and there's no money involved, just a certificate or a plaque if you actually win, I guess. You know, and some of the big contest stations even have corporate sponsors, you know, because they put the sponsors' names on the QSL cards, etc. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess it's ultimately just bragging rights. And, you know, I mean, that's part of human nature as well. People like to brag. And, you know, even if it doesn't get you a plaque, you know, you put it up on your QRC page, and the world is your oyster. You know, among the aficionados, most contesters know the champion contesters. Every so often I'll pick up a QST or a 73 or what have you, and the second half of the damn magazine is just full of tiny, teeny little prints of all kinds of guys that made points with some contest someplace. And I'm sure they're sitting around with a magnifying glass and highlighting their entry in it. You know, what can I tell you? Different people have different ways to scratch their itches.
Yeah. So far, I just think it's kind of too expensive to use a shared resource that long. I haven't gone back to doing any real contesting with remotes, but for chasing awards, it's going to be... It's pretty cool. You know, it's fun to win things even when there's no, you know, and get listed in the magazine and all that kind of stuff. You know, as you say, to each of them, you know, other people, you know, you like to actually talk to people, you know, which is what it's all about. But that's fine, too. Which Namibian station did you work on 10 meters, by the way? Go ahead.
I forget his call. His name is Mike. I've talked. There's other people who are regulars on the repeater that have talked to Mike. One of them is George, KD2FIU. But offhand, I don't remember his call sign.
Did he call into the net, or you just happen to find him on when you were tuning around?
No, actually, we had called an end to the net about 5-10 minutes before, and I was just kind of listening to the band, and he pokes up out of nowhere, and I turned the radio back on and started to talk with him, and other people did as well.
Yeah, that's good. I actually don't think I have that one, at least not confirmed on 10 meters yet. But I'm up to 114 confirmed on 10 meters. I finished, I didn't have a confirmed DXCC on that band. And once the sunspot cycle came up, I finished it very quickly. Have I submitted that one? No, I don't think I've been holding off on submitting that one since I'm not sure whether I will or not, because that can count. It's going to take me a long time to finish 80 to get the 5-band. I may decide to submit it, or once I finish 12 and 17. But anyway, I think I may still be missing that on 10 meters, so that's a nice one. Go ahead.
Okay. I can barely read my scribble. I think it's Z51MA.
Sure that wasn't Z31MA in Belize. Somebody with a very similar call in Belize who's on a lot. Go ahead.
No, I double-checked it with QRZ. It's Z51MA. His name is Mike. Let's see, Windhoek, Namibia is his area that his call sign is located in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because there's a couple of guys in Belize who were on a lot with very similar call signs to the guys in Namibia. There's just like one number difference. But yeah, Windhoek, I think, is the only notable city there. Posted a couple of times on a couple of bands, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was amazed the first time. I was astounded the second time. At least the first time, 10 meters was rather open. We were talking to guys in the Northwest and the Midwest, and so it wasn't completely outlandish, although it was really out there. But the second time I talked to him, which was, I forget when, about a couple of weeks after that, then conditions were awful, and yet he still came through. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I will be talking to Mike again on Saturday. I hope so. I look forward to it. It's, you know, things like that kind of interest me. That's sort of the closest I get to DX or contesting or what have you. You know, whether it's 5.9 or 4.7 or 3.2 or whatever, I don't know. As you mentioned, I'm more interested in kind of the content of the conversation. But, you know, occasionally even I can be impressed by how amazing RF propagation is sometimes.
Yeah, it really is weird and unpredictable sometimes. And those transequatorial paths are interesting because propagation in the tropical zone is completely different than what we experience here. And, of course, you get propagation north and south from there. I was listening on 17 meters at about noon our time. It was, I think it was XC5K on 17 meters. It was very loud on the East Coast. I couldn't get through. There's just too many people calling on a Sunday. But I really want to work that one. But anyway, I mean, you look at the gray line, you know, they're 12 hours off. It's about midnight there. He's booming through on 17 meters. It gets some really strange north-south propagation when you don't hear much east and west. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the allure of the hobby, in my humble opinion. If it was as consistent and dependable as a cell phone link, I don't think too many people would be that interested. You know, if you kind of know that you pick something up and you can do it, the same thing any old time, then most likely you don't tend to pick it up. But if you know, occasionally wonders occur, that you're always searching for those magic moments.
Yeah. Yeah, we have an invite for the talk about spending a lot of money, you know, just for the bragging rights. I have an invite to do CQ Worldwide Sideband 2024 from Vanuatu, which is literally the middle of nowhere in the Pacific. Kind of hard to, you know, it's, I think, a 5 or 6 hour flight from Honolulu, never mind from here, you know. And I'm like, do I really want to go that far? But on the other hand, it would be a heck of a lot of fun to operate from a tropical location, sound, you know, surrounded by water. I did that once from Trinidad back in 1988, and that was a hoot. But this would really be a hoot, especially a more for a more serious operation. Go ahead. I may decide, my wife and I may decide, it's just too darn far, and we're not going to do it. But I'm giving it some thought anyway. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, Trinidad is a pretty place, and you could do other things there, and everything is kind of set up for you ahead of time. A lot of these little pokey islands in the middle of nowhere aren't set up for anything. So first you have to figure out how to get to it, then you have to figure out how to land on it in a reversible manner, and then you have to set up camp because they usually don't have any power, they don't have any running water, they don't have this, that, and the other thing, and so, you know, it's kind of like a survival camp almost. I don't know. I was never a big camper, so none of that really appeals to me. It's a challenge, but, you know, it's always holding your breath, and I don't plan on doing that anytime too soon, so I guess I don't want to rain on anyone's parade. It's just I've read about these things in the past, and, you know, I've never kind of aspired to them. My response tended to be, why? I mean, I vaguely could understand why, but functionally, I mean, why do you want to discomfort yourself so badly?
For the same reason people want to climb Mount Everest, which has a 1 or 2% casualty rate, you know, the same risk as an astronaut or an infantryman, you know, and people do that just for fun. I mean, give me a break. That's crazy. I think one guy a couple of years not only summited Mount Everest, but then got on the air for a couple of hours to put the summit on the air. Talk about something crazy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think I read about that. No, Port Vila Vanuatu is a resort. It's very popular with Australians. It's 1,500 miles from Sydney. They have a 737 flies out. Now that the pandemic is over, they just resumed service flying a 737 out from Sydney a couple of times a week. So the thought of flying a 737 over water for a couple of hours doesn't necessarily thrill me either. It's a resort sea expedition, so it's more like Trinidad and Tobago, where I operated from the top floor of the what's now the K-Pac Hilton, the Hotel K-Pac, back then. Anyway, so it's at least in theory a little more similar to that trip than it is to, say, 3Y0, Bouvet. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, very good. So it's just an exotic tourist location, which, you know, which I makes more, much more sense to me. Again, the stories that I heard about these rocks that just kind of jut out of the sea, that a bunch of guys decide that they're going to strap a shack onto with a power generator and some aerials and make contact. I understand it's a challenge. I understand that climbing a very high mountain is a challenge. You know, again, other than the bragging rights, what exactly do you get? What I think is amazing is that there are guys like, I don't know if you keep up with British actors, there's this really interesting character called Brian Blessed, and I think he climbed up that damn mountain at least once. He's I think he's in his 80s at this point. He could probably beat the crap out of me when I was 40 years younger than him. So, you know, I mean, some guys who challenge in nature are fascinating people.
It is fascinating stuff. Anyway, yeah, no, the only thing I could possibly do at this point is a resort the expedition. I couldn't do a real one. I'm just not up to it. Like you said, I'm not a camper. Anyway, I'm many people around, but anyway, I know this is TechNet, not a Cobra TechNet, so I'll let you go. I do a couple of things, and then I'll try to be back on here for SpaceNet. Go ahead, Roy. WB2BXO.
AT2GS. Well, thank you very much, Frank, for participating. I always look forward to our conversation here on the Technical Net. Jim, I heard you out there. What do you have to say today?
I was enjoying the conversation, and I thought I'd chime in on the outdoor thing. I, too, don't get the motivation of the crazy adrenaline junkies outdoors, but I do get a lot of the outdoor stuff. And aside from it just being something else to see and do and experience, I always find that the world that God made without our help is a neater, more impressive place than the world that we made. And both are a part of our existence, and they is something to be gained from both. That's my perspective on what you were talking about. I figured I would throw it in there.
Okay, Chip. Well, you got to keep in mind, nature can be beautiful, but nature can be ugly, and nature can be very dangerous. Nature has killed probably more people than any other noun I could think of. A couple of years ago, one of my puzzle questions was, what animal has caused the greatest death of human beings other than human beings? And that was just animals, but nature can be a bitch, as the old saying goes.
There is no doubt about that. Absolutely true. And nature in our area is relatively benign. You get out a few miles around the country, and the creatures get much bigger, and the hills get much bigger, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm not the adrenaline junkie for this stuff, but I do enjoy being out in the places where there's few people. I spend a lot of time where there's more density than just about anywhere on Earth. I enjoy the opposite also.
Well, I mean, it's no surprise that places where large cities popped up tend to be kind of relatively safer than other parts of the world. Usually you find cities located very close to waterways, either the ocean or major rivers, because that's a cheap, easy means for transportation, and so civilizations take and use that rather well. One of the earliest civilizations that come to mind is the Egypt and Mesopotamia, and Egypt had the Nile. And Mesopotamia had the Euphrates, and I always forget the other river, but it had two rivers. There are beautiful landscapes. There are parks that are kind of designed to demonstrate the beauty that is nature. But there are some parts of this world that is not habitable by almost anyone. Don't book a trip to Antarctica unless you're really interested in wearing a lot of warm clothing most of the time.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that's one. The expedition we talked about a couple of months ago. It was early February, and these guys were going to go out to Bouvet Island, and that was just not far from Antarctica. And there's nothing on this island. Like you said, it's probably just a rock and maybe a couple of trees. And these people, got onto the island, and they had nothing but problems, bad weather, and they wanted to make, you know, like 100,000 contacts, and they wound up staying for only like 3 days. They were going to stay for, you know, a week or two, and they wound up leaving. But, you know, that's a perfect example. There's nothing there. I mean, no running water, no anything. And, you know, but they wanted to put that one on the air because it's the second most desired DX station. So I guess maybe in another 10 years from now, somebody will do the same thing. I don't know. And hundreds of thousands of dollars, all kinds of donations and everything went into getting these people there. Fascinating. I got a with a P40V, you know, and I got the QSL card hanging on the wall. There's about 30 guys sitting there in the sun, you know. That sounds good. Back to you.
Yeah, there are better locations. I understand why it's a difficult location to grab because no one in their right mind would run a station on a rock like that. But different pleasures for different people. I'm just wondering in the back of my mind if I hope this hobby continues into the distant future, and I wonder at what point some group of crazy guys will get together and finance a trip to, say, the moon, to activate the moon, be the first guy to activate the moon, not from a bounce, but from an actual location.
Oh, I guarantee that will happen, you know. I think about it, 30 years ago, you wouldn't think maybe somebody's going to be transmitting from a space station on amateur radio. And meanwhile, it's done on a regular basis. So, that Aruba thing was very good. The one for Bouvet Island, the one that canceled, not so good. They were going to run, well, I guess they did. They got like 5,000 contacts. CW, single sideband, FTA. I think FTA would have been the way to go because they had problems with their antennas and trouble getting out, they said, and all. Anyway, back to you, Rick.
Yeah, I wonder, Dick used to tell the stories of how he borrowed a piece of equipment from the company he worked for to pick up the signals for the Apollo mission. I wonder if something like that is purchasable, you know, is a decrease in price enough that an average home without a government checkbook can buy to kind of get anywhere close to specs to the radio that Dick used.
Yeah, I think that was all S-band. They still use that. But I think in the future they're going to be using, KA, KU, probably on a regular basis. So, you know, I'm sure it would be able to do it. And who knows, maybe by that time they're going to have encrypted people living on the moon and Earth. I think it was great and it was at the right time. So it was doable. Somebody had the ability to do it. Yeah, he got a lot of stuff from AIL. He used to work for AIL. We talked about that quite a bit. Back to you, Rick.
Yes, indeed. I mean, many people have really bad memories of the Cold War. I was a little too young to really understand the Cuban Missile Crisis at the time, but it was scary times, and there was the version of preppers back in those days, guys who would build these bomb shelters, as if a nuclear bomb went off, wouldn't affect you if you were in a bomb shelter that was... And it didn't have its own ventilation system or anything. It was a very weird time. I kind of was a little bit too young for the nuclear strike practice in school, you know, where they would teach you to roll and whatever you know, go underneath your desk where nuclear bombs couldn't reach you or something like that. But you know, the one thing that it did do was it set up this dynamic where people wanted to best the Soviets. And one of the things that was a competition was the space race. I think without the Soviets competing against us, the general public wouldn't be interested enough to pay the bills. So, you know, some terrible things created good things.
Okay, I remember the duck and cover. But not, we didn't do it at the desk. They sent everybody out into a hall. You were supposed to sit down and wait for the big blast. Now, they figured the block walls, to walk down the hallways of a lot of schools, they had, you know, regular cinder block walls, you know, with mortar in between. And that was a lot better than sitting in the classroom next to the window, you know. And that was going to save you.
Well, they were either the most optimistic human beings known to mankind, or they were just focused as best they could in making stuff up.
KB2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Thanks. I've commented on this before, but I think it is an overly dismissive feeling to those practices these days. If you look into the effects of the nuclear warfare, while the people that are incinerated, there's no helping. There's a vast amount of people, more 10 times that amount of people in the surrounding area, that will see a flash, walk to the window, and then be shredded by the glass of the windows if they keep looking in the direction. If they just go behind something, they're fine. And if 1 million people are incinerated, 10 million or 100 people can be either shredded or just fine. So it was actually an excellent technique that gets poo-pooed without thinking it through. And it killed the whole concept of civil defense, where we should have some responsibility for our survival in any situation. So just food for thought. I figured I'd throw that in there.
Okay, I mean, usually no one speaks in favor of duck and cover. The problem is that nuclear holocausts are kind of complicated. You might save yourself from the projectiles that enter into your environment, but you're probably crowded with a boom of radioactive material which will kill millions afterwards due to radiation.
B2BX with a cup. Roy, the signal continued, but your voice faded out.
Oh, okay. That's curious. I wonder why. Maybe someone has a problem with what I'm talking about right now. I don't know. So, how's my signal now?
The audio's a little on the low side, but it's perfectly functional now.
Okay. I was just presupposing that in some cases, unfortunately, the only thing you get to choose is whether you want to die quickly and relatively painlessly or slowly and very painfully. Local contamination of the air, the water, the food, and what have you. That's the problem I see with bomb shelter type technologies. If you have some means of filtering and recirculating, reoxygenating somehow the air, then okay, makes sense. But otherwise, where are you getting the air from? Probably from the outside. How are you protecting yourself from the radiation, dust, and plumes? You can filter it, but probably not enough.
Obviously, a very complicated situation, and every person would be in a different situation. But my point is that because of the huge nature of these events, even a single event, there's an enormous radius around it where people can be relatively unaffected or heavily affected by small measures. And it's totally doable, and they can make life survivable for enormous amounts of people. It has nothing to do with the people underneath the thing. They're dust. But there's a huge radius and potentially in population centers, enormous amounts of people that can come out scot-free or be maimed and shredded. So it does have tremendous, small things to make a very big difference in this field. And it's, I've been trained a bit in it, and there's some logical, simple steps that are not hard to do, like stepping away from the window when you see a flash. Changes the whole outcome.
Okay, that's very useful information. Again, when duck and cover was a big thing, I hadn't quite even gotten into elementary school yet, so I really just discussed things like that. And it's always been kind of apocryphal stories that other people have told me. So, I mean, you add an extra layer of reality to it, and I have a better appreciation, thanks to you. I'm glad that we did not have to test anyone's theories about any of this, and saner heads, kept us from killing ourselves, although we came close. The Cuban Missile Crisis, there was another episode, I believe, where the Soviet Union picked up a bogey that was a computer glitch, and primarily because the guy in charge of pushing buttons decided not to push buttons, but we're still able to tell the story. So I guess luck has had an important part to play in this all.
No doubt about that. If you don't mind, I want to backtrack to something you were speaking of just before this happened. You were talking about different folks' motivations for getting on the radio, as it were. You mind if I go back to that for a second?
Sure. Frank wanted to say something, though, so let's have give Frank a little time to get through Echolink, and then we'll get right back to you. Okay, Jim?
Roger.
Yeah, very good. I recall on 9/11, I was working in the 275-77 U.S., I think it was the Union Building in Chelsea, just outside of, about 25th Street, kind of just outside the zone. And I remember the aircraft bus. Anyway, everybody was clustered at the south window watching the buildings burn. And I stood with my HT and flip phone in the hallway. People were like, why are you standing in the hallway and not watching the rest of us? And I was like, well, because when I visited my relatives in London in the 1970s who survived the Blitz, I remember they said they felt in their neighborhood the only civilians who were killed were those who stood on the roof with the binoculars watching the raids and got hit by shrapnel, and everyone else who did what they were supposed to do and went into the troop stations and went into the apartment building basements were fine. So I decided on 9/11 to follow that rule and stay in a well-protected hallway. One other comment, wonder why the Russians haven't used nukes in Ukraine. Well, they built very deep subway systems in Kiev and Kharkiv that were intended to double as nuclear bomb shelters. So those two cities, and probably a couple of others in Ukraine, have the best bomb shelters in the world. So they're not going to kill everybody by using a nuke there. They may destroy all the infrastructure, but they're not going to kill everybody, and their main goal is to depopulate the place, go ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've heard about the they've been using them for the last year as bomb shelters. They seem to be very effective, fortunately.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact pattern. You know, that small differences can make a big difference. I would think that there's other reasons why the Russians haven't used nuclear weapons there that have little to do with actually what's happening in Ukraine and what would happen in the larger world. That's probably a more important reason. But small defensive measures like stepping in the hallway can change the whole outcome for many, many people in these bad situations.
And Roy, your audio, you were suddenly like 80% noise. I don't know what the evolution is. I kind of connected and you just moved the HT or something. Anyway, I'm going to go back to listening. Got to get a couple of things done here. WB2BX.
Curious question. It costs something like $10 million to refresh a nuke. And I tend to not think that the Russians are spending billions of dollars refreshing their nukes. I think they've used it to buy dachas and yachts and rent-a-girlfriends and such. So I'm not quite sure exactly how many effective nuclear weapons they have these days. And I would hate to find out under any circumstance.
Agreed to that.
Anyway, Jim, you wanted to bring up the subject of what motivates people into the hobby?
Yeah, you addressed a number of the factors that were definitely reasonable and well considered. Some people enjoy the technical nature of it. Some people enjoy the challenge. Some people enjoy talking to other people, like you mentioned. Some people enjoy talking to other people who are like them or similar in mindset or that type of thing. But the real adventurers enjoy talking to people who don't think like them and can have a constructive conversation and ideas around that are different than theirs. And I like to pretend I'm one of those crazy adventurers, but I think that's an unrecognized piece of the puzzle in this so-called hobby.
Well, it can be rather problematic. There are so many hotspots and so many tribal concepts that it's very easy to walk on a landmine. There is a benefit to a dispassionate, hopefully, conversation based on agreed-upon facts and interpretations of facts to be different, but there shouldn't be two separate sets of facts. In concept, I agree with you. I mean, you learn more from people with different perspectives if they're well thought out. If they're not well thought out, you're just kind of asking to have an argument with someone, which made a great skit on Monty Python, but I wouldn't want to kind of do that myself personally.
All good points, well taken. But I will submit that if there's any place in the world where there is a place and a space and people that could do that, it would be here in some portion of ham radio world. I think there's a lot of benefits to it. You're out of striking distance from the other people. You have reasonably responsible communicators. I think it's an underutilized social benefit of this system. And I just wanted to bring it up for thought. I know you probably don't want to drag on about it, but I just wanted to make that point. Thank you for giving me the moment.
Well, you're welcome, Jim. It's an interesting point. And on a theoretical basis, again, I would agree with you. In the practical one, you kind of have to pick your people and your topics because it's very easy for them to erupt into, I've heard people basically almost give themselves a stroke arguing about antenna theory. Politics and religion and philosophy and all manner of things. Again, if you can kind of do a dispassionate type of discussion, then great. But very few of us seem to be able to stay dispassionate about a lot of things. Especially lately, it's grown way too easy to annoy each other. And that's a terrible thing to say, but, that's what I've noticed lately.
Again, all accurate statements, but I would just say that we, all of us, are going to have to figure out a way around, over, or through this problem. And I think somewhere in the ham radio spectrum is a good place to start. That's what I believe. And again, thanks for humoring me.
No, it's fine, Jim. I appreciate your thoughts on this subject. It would be a curious experiment to try a test based on such a thing. Again, my cynical assessment would be, you know, you probably would just be betting on the number of minutes it takes for people to meet each other's relatives and suggest that they were having sex with farm animals and such.
Yeah, there is that. There is that. It's a challenge, but like Everest and the moon and whatnot, I think it's a challenge worth considering. Again, not necessarily in any particular place. We have a wide spectrum to work with, but I think it's worth considering. Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome, Jim. And you know, if you ever experiment and come to any kind of conclusion of, you know, if it is theoretically possible, I mean, like anything, I mean, there are perfect storms where you know, the two people are kind of emotionally able to detach themselves a little bit and cite agreed upon facts. And at least, if not convince the other, at least use it as an opportunity to introduce the other person to different perspectives and different ways of understanding the facts that are mutually agreed upon. So, if you ever happen upon that and want to tell us how it went, I'd love to.
Very good. I'll keep it in mind. Your signal seems to be deteriorating over here. Thanks again. I want to be listening. KD2VHD, listening on the side.
Okay. I'm going to rev up my transmitter as much as I can. You know, maybe the rainy weather and such is affecting the repeater. I do not know. I'm looking at my tracing. I'm tracing my Echo Link audio. It seems to be a reasonable amplitude. So I don't know. I can't hear it because it has a little bit of a delay, and if I listen to myself with, you know, a 500 or a 1,000 millisecond delay, it scrambles my brain a wee bit.
Likewise, I can't take that. Your signal did just eclipse into much improved just now.
Okay, I'm pumping out about 50 watts. I in the old days, I was able to put about 8 or 9 watts. That was more than enough for the 2-year-old repeater. But these days, I usually settle on about 20, 25, and so right now it's 50. So hopefully it will be sufficient for the remainder of the technical mess. So thanks, Jim. As always, you have interesting topics for discussion. And, you know, if you discern anything in future about, unfortunately, I have listened to many bands and many nets and many groups of guys who get together, but they tend to kind of have mutually agreed upon topics, and they seem to be of a similar mindset, so I have not seen much, interesting discourse on disagreements of you know, important aspects of life.
Yeah, understood. I've heard them also. So it's a dream. I'll keep at it.
Okay, very good. And I hope your dream comes true. Again, I would love the opportunity to have adult conversations about some things which unfortunately lately have been few and far between. You don't kind of get the William Buckley debates anymore, even on talking head news channels and such. You get people talking in a mirror to themselves for the most part.
There certainly is that.
Okay, very good. Once again, I remain AC2GS. Roy here with the Limark Technical Net. We still have a little bit of time to play with, so if anyone out there has any comments to make about anything that we've discussed before, or new comments, or questions, or topics of interest, please hit that push-to-talk button.
No, Ember 2, Victor Hotel, Zulu, Hopi on the brass there.
Hello, how are you this fine day? I saw you were on Echo Link earlier tonight before the technical mess.
Yes, sir, I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking. By the way, the propagation is completely down. No way to get into the Kings County net. It's terrible here. Sorry. One of the comments about the missile, about the nuclear holocaust. Out here in Nebraska and northern Colorado and Wyoming, there's thousands of missiles in the ground. Most of them are empty because of the agreement made a couple of years ago, but lots of them still have missiles in them, and they're all scattered about in groups of three. You can see them quite clearly right off the highway. Little pods in groups of three with missiles in most of them. And they're ready to go. Kind of scary out here. Thank you.
Yeah, that was our three-prong approach. We have missiles on the ground, we have missiles in the water, and we have missiles in the air. We are up to our public in missiles. And the funny thing about those silos is there's a couple of guys at the bottom of the silo because they have to turn a keys simultaneously in order to trigger. They're not automated systems, thankfully.
Yeah, I'm driving west on Highway 2 in Nebraska. It's interesting because you see them right off the highway about a couple hundred yards, and they have a fence around it, of course. They're all similar with video cameras. They say, you know, they'll use deadly force if you approach the fence anymore, any closer than what the sign says. And then there's a house, a little house, probably with an elevator that brings us down into the silo. And drive on a highway for any distance to see many, many of these, you know, and they're all, you know, along the, especially in Nebraska, and then you go into South Dakota, they have them. And, you know, we'll know when the Holocaust starts because we'll just see them fire off. And you'll see them at night go up into the sky. It'll be horrible. You know, it's a horrible thought. And it's just something nobody wants to think about because it's literally the end of the world, you know. Back to you.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately humanity's coping mechanism. People don't think about it. As much as they like to push the doomsday clock closer and closer to midnight, I think with the end of the Soviet Union, we got a little bit of a break. Problem is, over time, slowly more and more countries are going to have access to this weaponry, and eventually our luck is going to run out, and some raving lunatic is going to push luck. You know, I mean, humanity has a very warped, strange sense of humor. When they came up with one of the names for the strategy that we had used during the Cold War, they came up with mutually assured destruction, MAD. So who says these defense people don't have a sense of humor?
I remember that very clearly. And only one last thing I wanted to say. They were so nervous. When I was in the Army in Germany, and we didn't know what happened that day. So we moved out, and I, at the end of my little dissertation, I'll tell you what happened. We all loaded up. We all had live ammunition. We went away. They said to us, this is it. You're going, and you might not ever come back. So we went, and we landed by helicopter on the East German border. And we all prepared. Everything moved to the East German Czechoslovakian border. And what happened was Chernobyl. Chernobyl exploded. But we thought, in the Army, we were told that a nuclear weapon misfired in Czechoslovakia. But it wasn't. It was Chernobyl in Ukraine exploded. But the entire United States Army in Germany was moved to the border, prepared to invade Czechoslovakia and East Germany if they were told to do so. Because they thought a nuclear weapon had misfired and they were moving towards the border. A tactical nuclear weapon. A small one that would destroy 1 kilometer of a grid square of a map. So we moved out, prepared to go to war that day. But it never happened because they realized that it was in the Ukraine and it wasn't a weapon. It was a power plant. So that's how much everybody was nervous about everything back then. But I'll never forget that day, you know? And that's what I have to say for now before I lose contact with the repeater. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Ken. That's a good one. I don't think I was familiar with, obviously we all know Chernobyl, but I was not familiar with the Army's readiness condition when they detected something going awry. Yeah, I mean, we were living in really scary times where at any odd moment some erratic programming glitch could have provoked World War III, and somehow we got away without it happening. I hope our luck continues. Yes, you know, the more variables, the more different possible places people would start with the button to launch weapons like this. You know, we have North Korea now. Eventually, we'll have Iran, and more will join in. And that doesn't improve the odds, in my humble opinion. But thanks for that story, Ken. I appreciated it.
You're very welcome. I'm going to lose connectivity with the rest of the world shortly. So I'm going to have to say 7-3s and back out. And thank you. I check HF every day. I check 10 meters. I check 12 meters, you know, 15 meters, and all the other bands. And all I have to say is that out here, the propagation is not too good anymore. It went F1 to F2, and then it just dropped out. So let's see what happens. I check every Saturday for the Kings County net. Can't hear it. I hear nothing on 10 meters. But I'm trying, and we'll see if it improves over the summer. And that's all I got to say. 7-3 from Nebraska out here on Highway 2. It's 8 o'clock sharp. PM. N2GHD Mobile. Ken signing off. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, 7310. Have a good ride. Have a good week. And maybe, hopefully, we'll talk again next Sunday, either on 10 meters or here on Echo Link. Yeah, 10 meters has not been doing terribly well. This is probably one of the few times where this Sunday morning where I am the net control operator for a 10-meter net, we didn't get any DX at all. Occasionally, I'll have one guy from Texas, but this time it was all, we went from Staten Island to Queens, and that's as far as we got this week. And although there was a station that sounded earlier in the morning like it came from Utah, I'm not quite sure. I could barely make out what he was saying, but I don't know. 10 meters has been much better in previous months. Hopefully, they'll return again. We haven't even reached the sunspot maximum of sunspot number 25. So thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate your participation here. This is, once again, AC2GS. We still have a little bit more time, so if anyone has any comments, feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Years ago, we had nukes out east, a place called Beaumont, Beaumont Missile Base, out in West Hampton. And it was built in, I guess, the mid-1950s. I started operating, I think, around 1958, 59. And then they lasted about 5 or 6 years, and then they decommissioned it. But they had them out there, and they were regular nukes. I was working with, they were older at the time, they were actually on the job, you know, they were doing piping and things like that. I used to tell that story. But now if you go on to, actually a government site, they talk about it. It's completely different commission. I think the only thing left is a couple of big plates or something that's to cover. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay. Living in the world is probably was famous for having bomb shelters. I think bomb shelters was more of a West Coast or a Midwest phenomenon than it was in Brooklyn. I could be wrong. Anyway, cutting up in little bits and pieces for some strange reason. I do not know what the repeater is playing around with, but I'm watching as it kind of breaks up and comes back and breaks up. So it's some kind of, I don't know, the reception is kind of erratic. I'm putting out something like 50 watts consistently. I have a power meter here just to check on this, so I don't know.
Okay, that was 100%, but, you know, very noisy. At least it was 100% copy. It sounds like conditions to me, you know, due to the weather that's, you know, given us our problems for the last couple of days. It looks like there's like one storm left for me anyway, coming to me probably around 11 o'clock tonight. And I'm not sure about where you are. My guess is from the weather. It's okay on the last transmission.
Okay, I mean, I'm getting sort of the same thing from you. There's kind of a background noise that goes anywhere from about 30 to 60, 70%, and then occasional fraction of a second dropout.
Oh, okay, very good. I want to back up the high power then. We'll stick with this later on when we talk about space programs. This is probably a lot better.
Yeah, it's much better. There's still a little background noise. I'm not quite sure what the problem is with the repeater. It seems to be going a little bit of depth. Might be weather conditions, as you suggested.
I agree. You know, you're noisy, but that was good. Every now and then, though, you know, not many times, a couple of times you dropped out earlier tonight and just before, but you've recovered. It's, I'm sure it's conditions.
Okay, you know, what can I tell you? I mean, I'm kind of at the edge of Glen Oaks, the reception area. Every so often people talk about putting some device in Brooklyn to kind of link to the other repeaters to kind of stabilize it and maybe get a better reception for people located in Staten Island and such. But someday, who knows?
Very good. You know, when I was younger, you know, still living at home, I lived in Queens, and I probably lived less than a mile in walking distance from the buildings that, you know, that we used for the repeater. So I watched those buildings go up little by little, you know, from the window. And, of course, I wasn't a ham back then, but if I was, I could have worked that thing with a 1/10 of a milliwatt. I was so close to it. But anyway, it was pretty cool watching that, those buildings go up. Back to you, Roy. You're doing better.
Okay, good. The one constant for the most part in the city of Long Island is buildings keep going up. There was a time, unfortunately, in the Bronx, where a lot of buildings were going down. But hopefully we're over and we're done with things like that. So every so often people will talk about what to do about the buildings surrounding repeater sites. The more buildings, the more